Earlier this year, white nose syndrome was found in a single Wisconsin cave, and while it's certainly cause for concern for our bat population, the bat ecologists in our state have been preparing for this and are responding to the threat as well as can be expected. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Really pleased to have back in the studio with me Jennifer Riddell, who is a conservation biologist, cave and mine specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Jennifer, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And with me as well, David Bleard is the branch chief for the Wildlife Disease Diagnostic Laboratories for the U.S. Geologic Survey's National Wildlife Health Center. And I guess what you need to know is that he's the guy. He is the leading authority on white nose syndrome in bats. So we're really pleased to have him with us as well. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Larry. I hope I can live up to that.
Oh, you will. You will, I'm sure of that. Let me start with Jennifer, though. We have seven species of bats living in Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
And they are, let's see, what do we got?
So we have three species that are considered migratory or tree roosting species mm-hmm. during the summertime. And that's the eastern red bat, the silver-haired bat, and the hoary bat. And those are bats that leave for the winter, for warmer climates to spend the winter. And then we have four species that remain here in Wisconsin over the course of the winter. And those are the hibernators or the cave bats. And so really the difference is that the tree species do not use caves. But our four cave bats are also our most common species. So big brown bats, little brown bats, the most common bat in North America. And then, of course, northern long-eared bats and the smallest bat in the state, the eastern pipistrelle.
Yeah, how big is that? How small is that?
The eastern pipistrelle's body is about the size of an adult's thumb, sort of the pad and end of your thumb, and then there's tiny wings attached and a small head with a small face.
Little insect eater.
Yeah.
Little insect eater. David, why are bats so important for a healthy ecosystem?
Well, they play a number of roles. One is they're primary predators of insects. And then if you expand, that's what we would see in temperate regions like Wisconsin. But if you look globally, they also play important roles in the rainforests and seed dispersals. That would be fruit-eating bats, as well as there's nectar-feeding bats that are important pollinators.
So they play, they're important.
Yes.
We need to have them. And let's think about Wisconsin specifically, Jen. What do they contribute here?
Sure. We know that in addition to human health concerns and human pests like mosquitoes, our bats are important for both forestry pests and agricultural pests. So a study recently quantified the value of bats to Wisconsin agriculture, looking at the amount of pesticide that would need to be applied if we took bats off of the landscape. So if we look at high versus low crop pest years, the value of bats to our farmers is between $658 million to $1.5 billion annually.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I guess even if you don't care about bats, to see them or to have one in your house maybe, you think about their value just in terms of economic sense. It's worth preserving and protecting them.
It is, and I think it's worth emphasizing, as Jennifer just stated, the insect pests that she's speaking of are moths that do forest and agricultural crop damage. So we often think of bats as mosquito eaters, and they are, but primarily they do eat a lot of moths that have impacts on agriculture and forests.
Talking today with our two guests, David Bleard and Jennifer Riddell, about our bat population here in Wisconsin and the United States, and also taking a look at white nose syndrome. And I haven't given the number yet, so let me do that right now. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or comments, or even if you've got a bat photo, post that there as well. We'd love to see it. David, unfortunately, it's in the caves where white nose syndrome has been spreading, at least in other states. First, tell us, what is white nose syndrome?
So white-nose syndrome is an emergent fungal disease of bats. We believe, based on the research that we've been doing at the U.S. Geological Survey in collaboration with numerous others, that it's caused by a fungus that was inadvertently introduced to North America, something that's been present, we know, in European bat populations for a long time. And one of the challenges with a fungal disease is that almost all fungi are adapted to exist as decomposers in the environment. And then there's some fungi that also have this adapted specialty of becoming animal pathogens. But they're essentially dual function microbes. So that poses the challenge that this fungus not only grows on and attacks the skin of bats, which causes them to die during the hibernation season, but as it multiplies and falls off the bats, it ends up in the soil in the caves. And so you end up with these reservoirs of pathogen that allow the bats to become reinfected year after year.
And what does it do? Why is it deadly? So
it's a skin pathogen. Despite the name of the disease, white nose syndrome, the primary mechanism by which the fungus attacks the bats is to grow on their wings. And wing skin on a bat comprises over 80% of the skin on the entire animal.
Yeah.
It's a very delicate and specially adapted type of skin. And not only is it important for them to have healthy and intact wing skin to fly, but there's a number of other physiological functions moderated through the wing, involving circulation, temperature regulation, blood pressure regulation, even passive gas exchange while they're hibernating, and their respiratory rates are very much depressed. And so we believe that the fungus is perturbing all of these functions, disrupting their abilities to successfully hibernate and survive the winter.
And we saw it earlier this year, I guess it was, in where, Grant County? A cave in Grant County, wasn't it?
Yes. Maybe, I think Jennifer was there on
that.
Yeah,
so, you know, Wisconsin became one of what are now 25 states that where the disease has been confirmed, and five Canadian provinces. And so at a single mine, actually, in Grant County, we found a small number of bats hibernating that had visible signs of the fungus, and the fungus was confirmed at that site.
And was that completely unexpected? Did you expect that this is going to happen sooner or later?
Yeah, certainly unfortunately, given the progression of the disease and the rapid spread, we've been expecting to see this in Wisconsin now for a few years. And, you know, it was also found in the UP of Michigan this winter. And, you know, we're expecting that Wisconsin will be fully saturated within the coming couple of years.
Yeah. And so there's not, I mean, you couldn't remove those particular bats. It wouldn't do any good, likely.
Right. There's that challenge with this environmental reservoir. Once the fungus gets on the bats, their mine also becomes contaminated. So
yeah. And you can't, and obviously you can't keep them out of the cave. Well, I suppose you could. You could probably block it off, but then where do they go?
Correct.
Yep.
So these bats, you know, really need the buffered, warmer temperatures of caves and mines in order to survive the winter, and they need the highly humid conditions of these sites. And in Wisconsin, we have relatively few sites for those bats to congregate at during winter months.
Are they gone during the? If I'm a scientist thinking about this, if they're not around in the summer, can I go into the cave and fumigate it, or eliminate the soil? Or
so that's actually something that we've been discussing and thinking about. The challenge in these management strategies is that not only are you worried about managing the pathogen, but then there's many, many other microbes that just do the bats also play essential roles in those complex biological communities. So you have to be very careful to avoid taking that flamethrower approach and doing harm when you meant to do good.
Yeah, I suppose it's really a lot to think about.
Right. I mean, similarly, the strategy you were hearkening to before about removing those bats would be like a stamping out strategy where you remove the impacted animals. And that type of strategy, whereas it can be very effective in, say, a poultry barn, if a respiratory disease of chickens comes in, when it comes to wildlife, the time to institute that policy is when the disease is first detected. You know, by the time you already have it in Illinois and Indiana and Minnesota and Iowa. Doing management action of that type in Wisconsin wouldn't be beneficial because you'd have continued influx of infected animals from adjacent states.
Claire in Baraboo has a question about bats. Hi, Claire. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. A few years ago, somehow a bat got into my house, and it was in my bedroom for a few hours, unfortunately. It was quite a large bat, but beyond that, I couldn't tell you what kind it was. One of the animal control officers, this is on the police force in Baraboo, told me that a bat can bite a human without it ever being felt, you know, and that sounded kind of like an old wives' tale to me, but like I say, an animal control officer said it, so I'm wondering if that's a myth or if it's true.
So that's an interesting question.
Wouldn't be a bat that's here in Wisconsin, would it?
So the issue is that at a very low percentage, bats can become infected with rabies. They're not considered rabies carriers because bats die from rabies just as do humans. And the CDC and state public health agencies very closely track all incidents of rabies in humans. And there's a very small percentage of cases across the United States where people contract a bat variant of rabies, but have no known documented exposure to bats. And so that has led to that idea that a human who's in a deep sleep could be potentially bitten or scratched by a bat without knowing about it. So that is why the CDC recommends that if you find a bat in your house while you're sleeping, you should have that animal tested.
So there you go. And I was trying to remember a film that I watched once on bats in Trinidad and Tobago, and there are vampire bats in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And they can, I saw the film of a bat biting a cow, or mm-hmm. I think it was a cow, and they can do it so easily, or they can do it so well that the cow doesn't really know it's being bitten. So maybe that's where this all comes from. It's not the same as the bats we have here, I don't think,
right,
at all.
That would be a vampire bat.
Correct.
Yeah. So there we go. There you go, Claire. Thanks for calling. Kathy in Middleton area. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Say, we live, you know, outside Middleton, and we have quite a large bat population that live, like, in, we have this deck with a high roof with slats.
Yeah.
And so they crawl up there, and the way I know there's a lot of them because of all the, I call it the bat poop, you know, underneath.
Yeah. Well, no, sure.
And then they move. We've got two areas that they live, and they'll congregate in one area, and they'll stay there, and then they'll move to another area and be there for like 2 to 3 weeks, and then they'll come back again to the other area. And I'm just wondering why they move from one place to the other.
Sure. Well, Kathy, I'm really glad you're observing that, and certainly looking for guano beneath bat roosts.
Okay, that's the name.
Yeah, guano is the name, but that's certainly one way, you know, to tell where you've got roosting bats in or near your house. And as to why they're moving, it could have to do with the temperature of the area where they're roosting. And in the summertime, large numbers of little brown and big brown bats often gather to form maternity colonies, and I'm not sure if your site is a maternity colony or not.
Well, it is because, you know, I can see, like, sometimes I put, like, a container because it's such a mess, you know, to collect the guano, and sometimes the babies are sitting down in that, you know, in the morning when it's light out.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And so, you know, little brown bats and big brown bats in maternity colonies like to have temperatures be extremely hot. Now, if it gets too hot, for example, in later July and sometimes into August when we have those hot spells, they may decide to move to a cooler area, and that could be what you're noticing. But what I'll say is if you're already collecting some of the guano in a container just to remove it from the deck space, it makes a great fertilizer for your garden. So hang on to that.
Well, that's what I've been using it for. I go throw it in my asparagus patch. But then I'm wondering, do you believe they hibernate in this over winter then?
So occasionally
they don't leave, I don't think.
Sure. Occasionally big brown bats will attempt to hibernate in buildings, and so you know, specifically at this time of the year in the fall, as bats are on the move heading towards their hibernation sites, we sometimes, you know, get calls about big brown bats entering people's living spaces, and certainly they are occasionally found in attics and basements. Little brown bats, on the other hand, it's pretty rare that they would attempt to hibernate in a building. So depending on the species would sort of determine what might be going on in your space. But from what you've described, the space sounds fairly like it would be too cold, fairly exposed in the winter, and those two roosting species are the hibernators that really want to find a cave or a mine, ideally. Mm-hmm.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Sounds like a pretty cool experience that you're having there. Appreciate it very much. Talking today with David Bleard, who is the branch chief for the Wildlife Disease Diagnostic Labs with the U.S. Geologic Survey's National Wildlife Health Center, and Jennifer Riddell, conservation biologist and cave mine specialist with the BAT program at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Questions, comments, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. If you got a cool photo to share, and we'll talk about that in just a second, because we have got a cool one up on my Facebook page right now at the Larry Mehler Show. You can post one too right there. I'm Larry Mehler. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're getting an update on our Wisconsin bat population, talking about white nose syndrome as well, and previewing, which we haven't done yet, we better do it, the upcoming Wisconsin Bat Festival. Join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mehler Show. And Jamie sent us a photo on my Facebook page and says, this little guy or girl was hanging on the outside of my apartment the other day. Is it a little brown bat? Pretty cute, he says.
Yeah, that is a little brown bat. And, you know, typically this time of year, because bats are on the move, heading from their summer roost areas to their winter hibernation sites, we do find a lot of them on buildings. And remain for a day or two and then disappear.
Looks like he's hanging on to just the side of the building.
Yeah.
Stonework there.
Yeah, their little toes can really grab on to very, very little. About a 16th of an inch gap is all they need to hang on.
Wow. Well, and I mentioned the Wisconsin Bat Festival, and maybe we should talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So each year we've been doing a Wisconsin Bat Festival the last several years. It's been in Madison, and this year we've decided to give the folks in the Milwaukee area a chance to visit with some live bats from around the world. So this coming weekend, and it kicks off Friday night at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center in Milwaukee.
Oh, nice place
we'll
to go.
Have, yeah, Rob Myers from the Organization for Bat Conservation bringing in his live bats that he has from all over the world that are used for bat education programs. And so folks will have a chance to really come face-to-face with the largest bat species in the world, the Malayan flying fox, and some vampire bats and a number of others. So Friday night at Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, Saturday all day long, we'll have, again, live bat programs at the Urban Ecology Center in Riverside Park in Milwaukee. And we'll
another
have
nice place.
Yeah, a lot of other activities for families and children. There's an inflatable cave. You can learn firsthand about field techniques from bat biologists from around Wisconsin. And we'll have a science symposium. One of our featured presenters this year is Jenna Gazy, who's the only known rabies survivor. And she'll be telling her story. And Judith, from your show, your producer, will be interviewing Jenna at the festival. And then Sunday afternoon at the zoo, the Zoofari Conference Center near the Milwaukee Public Zoo, we'll have another live bat program. So events going on throughout the weekend, and you can check our DNR Bats page on our website to pre-register for the live bat programs. The event is free, but we highly recommend pre-registering so that you make sure you get a seat and get a chance to meet those bats.
That's wonderful. I'm sure we have a link on my Facebook page as well at the Larry Mehler Show. You can go there. Boy, it sounds like, and I imagine you're going to be there a whole weekend. Are both of you going to be there? Or?
I've been fortunate to participate the last couple of years, but won't be able to make it this year.
Yeah, and however, I'll be there, so come say hello.
Jennifer's going to be there, so go and say hello to her. And be sure to, you know, if you're a Wisconsin Public Radio listener and you've heard these two on the show, be sure to go on up and shake hands and say, hey, I listen to you on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'd love to have that as well. And same for Judith. Judith loves to talk with public radio listeners. She's just like me. I do, too. Chuck and Krivitz, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I guess I was just thinking about solving the problem of, you know, how these bats are congregating and spreading their disease. And I wondered if, because I'm thinking I live in a house where bats crawl underneath the split cedar shakes, and they always crawl into crevices. And I thought, is it possible to put some kind of grating over the mouth of these caves, where as the bats come in, they kind of swipe across the fungicide coating, and if that would help curb some of the disease issues?
Interesting idea. What do you think, David?
Well, so there are people that are doing research consistent with that idea right now, looking at different fungicides that could be used to control fungal burdens on bats, which even if it's not 100% effective, if you could shift the disease from lethal to sublethal, I think that mm-hmm. could also be considered effective. So a number of different mechanisms that are being investigated right now for treating bats, say, prior to entering these caves.
Sure. And one thing that I'll just add is that when we talk about potential management solutions or treatments for bats, specifically at caves and mines, we really have to kind of consider a lot of things. And so just one thing that comes to mind is that if we're asking bats to slow down and crawl through something at a cave or a mine entrance, that's a chance for predators to pick off bats. And so we really have a lot of concerns that we have to weigh.
Boy.
But, yeah, a good idea.
Thanks, Chuck. Appreciate the call. Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have a couple of questions here. One is, how are the bats doing in the cave up in Iron Mountain? And the next one is, how does an animal as small as a bat who lives in that attic with that intense heat, how does he get enough hydration? And then if you could talk about the type of moth that evolved with the ability to jam the bat's radar. I also found that very fascinating.
Hmm. All right.
Well, sure. So the first part of your question was about the bats. I think you're asking about the Millie Hill mine in Iron Mountain, Michigan. And I do believe that was one of the sites in the UP that was infected this year. And really, that being the state of Michigan, I can't comment on what the status
doing.
Is yeah, at that site. But certainly, white nose was found widespread throughout the UP this year. I think the second part of your question
hydration.
About hydration, you know, when they're in those hot attic spaces and roosting in the summer, they are leaving. You know, they're sleeping during the daytime, but leaving just after sunset each night. And one of the things that we know, in fact, this is an opportunity for us to study bats, is we know that bats will first go to a water source when they leave for the evening. So a pond, a lake, a stream, and even people's garden ponds, bats will actually drink on the wing. They fly down and get a sip of water, lapping it up as they fly over the top. And, of course, those are good places for bats to continue foraging as well.
I think it's also worth mentioning that as hibernators, bats obviously have a much different tolerance for temperatures. And so one of the reasons they seek out these very warm environments, given that they have this unique control over their metabolism, is if they can get their body very hot, you know, like your body, my body is 98.7 degrees. If they can get their body up to that temperature using the external environment to regulate it, then they can basically shut off their metabolism and stop burning through fat in order to or utilizing food to maintain that warm body temperature. And so it's actually part of the way that they reduce their needs for food and water.
Very interesting. And there was are you aware of the moth that has adapted to the point that it can disrupt a bat's radar or sonar. Radar, I guess. Huh?
There is, and I don't. Are you interested in commenting further on that,
David? I don't know that as a microbiologist, I don't know the specifics of that, but I am aware of it as well that the moth can emit sonic noises that effectively jam the bat's echolocation. And just another example of coevolution of strategies that prey avoids a predator.
Very cool. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. We have Will in Eau Claire, I believe, up next. Hi, Will. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was actually just wondering, I've wondered this generally for a long time, but in this specific instance, what would be, is there a possibility that the bats could evolve past the white nose fungus and then, that's it. And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Sure. So my hope is, yes, that there will be. I think that as humans, being that we very likely played a role in inadvertently introducing this pathogen to North America, that we should try to understand the problem as best we can, both for the purpose of assisting to manage this disease as well as to prevent future occurrences with other pathogens. But one way that I think realistically we can approach disease control is through the concept of managed evolution. So there's likely some interventions that we can take that may or may not help the bats. But we know that simple things like habitat protection, creating habitat such that bats can naturally evolve to tolerate the pathogen without us exerting further pressures on them, I think is a way that we as people, scientists, interested stakeholders can help make this happen.
And it was first in Europe, right? Or at least it's been in Europe for quite a long time. And has there been that sort of evolution going on over there, or don't we really know?
What we see when we look at European bat populations is that almost all bats are affected by this pathogenic fungus, but that we don't see the unusual mortality levels that we see when it first sweeps through a population as we see here.
So evolution probably has played some sort of role.
Yes, in terms of the animals and their populations coexisting with the pathogen.
Yeah.
It may be that the future of... So let me back up a second. Sorry about that. European bat populations overall tend to be smaller than those that we see in North America.
Oh.
And those lower population levels could be a result of ongoing fungal pressures, that when there's fewer bats, providing less opportunity for the fungal pathogen to amplify, we don't see disease manifest at the levels that we see when the pathogen moves into a naive and very large bat population in the eastern United States.
I got an email from Jeff who said, I had a colony of bats roosting in my barn several years ago, and I wanted them out because they make a mess, so I put a couple of bat houses up on the outside of my barn and hoped they would find them and move out. Well, they found them, and now I have twice as many bats in the barn and in the bat houses. In subsequent years, I've learned to deal with the pile of bat guano in the barn by putting a cover over the floor during summer for easy cleanup. I love sitting out and watching the bats come and go in the evening during the summer. When should I expect bats to leave for the winter? I saw one flying around just last night.
Sure. Well, Jeff, I'm so glad that you've put up bat houses and continued to have success with the colony. I'm glad you're enjoying having them there. And good solution for guano. I know that's a concern for a number of people that have bat colonies in their barns and outbuildings. But depending on which species you have, either little brown or big brown bats, somewhat determines when those bats will be leaving for the winter. And, of course, the day-to-day temperature and specifically nighttime temperatures will determine that. So we've already seen as early as August 15th that little brown bats begin to move from their roost locations, like your barn, towards their winter hibernation sites. And those bats can go on a journey of up to 280 miles between those two areas. Big brown bats tend to leave a little bit later. In fact, it's certainly not unusual to see big brown bats flying around as late as November and even into early December, depending on the weather.
And a Facebook comment from Sharon, who says we have barn swallows in the daytime and bats at night. Farm animals means farm bugs. We need the help of our bug eaters, these bug eaters, to balance out our environment. So she's happy to see both.
Yeah, she's got the day shift and the night shift on insect control, so that's great.
That's wonderful. John and Shawamigan, your turn. Thanks a lot for calling.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm living in my great-grandfather's pioneer farmhouse, and as our family stories go, we've had bats in our attic for approximately 114 years now. And I've always assumed that these bats are over hibernating the winter in the attic. They're about the spread of my hand. So I was wondering if that would be the large brown bat. Are they staying for the winter? And then another interesting thing, we put up a guest house summer kitchen greenhouse about 15 years ago, and there's a bat that regularly comes in the evening and makes his rounds through, this building is vaulted, and makes his rounds through the vaulted spaces every evening when they start coming out and flying. And apparently he, you know, knows where to come in and knows where to get out.
Yeah.
So you have a nightly show. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So in terms of which species you have using the house, it's fairly simple to determine that actually just by looking at the guano that's left behind either on the side of the house where the bats are emerging from, or if you're able to see it up in the attic or wherever it's landing. And I believe we should have some photos on our website, and we could perhaps get those to Larry's Facebook page here as well, showing you the relative size of guano for big browns versus little browns compared to something like a coin or a pencil tip. So we're talking, in the case of little brown bats, guano pellets that are just a millimeter to 2 millimeters long. Big brown is just a little bit bigger than that, 3 to 4 millimeters.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, John, for calling. Steven, Sun Prairie. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I would like to know how to issue an invitation to bats to come and live at my house, not in it.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, one question I have for you, Steve, is how close are you located to the nearest water source, like a pond or a lake?
Well, I'm a little bit north of Sun Prairie in the town of Bristol, and there is a small stream, quarter of a mile, half mile north of me.
Okay.
And there is some standing water here and there.
Yeah, it's about a 30 acres pond of some sort there close by?
Well, as the crow flies, maybe a mile and a half south, there's a very large pond.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what I can tell you is, you know, bats like to be close to a water source. So we find a lot of little brown bat roosts within a quarter mile of the nearest water source. And as I was mentioning earlier in the program, they do drink on the wing and during flight. And so they really need a space that we usually find is something like 8 by 8 feet. To swoop down and actually glide across and be able to take that drink. So depending on the size of the stream or the pond or the ephemeral ponds in your area, that's a great indicator of whether or not you'll actually get bats should you decide to put up a bat house, because that's step number two. That would be to provide the appropriate roosting habitat for them. And we've got instructions for bat houses on our website. Again, it's really all about providing the correct type of house in a suitable location and hoping that they find it.
There you go.
And could you give me that address again?
Sure. So if you go to dnr.wi.gov, DNR website, there's a search bar, and you just type in bats, and that'll take you to our information.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks a lot, and I really appreciate listening to you today.
Sure, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. As you were talking about the width of the number of feet needed, I was hearkening back to quite a few years ago when I was trout fishing on Black Earth Creek with a friend of mine, Jerry Carbon, and he was standing in the stream, and it was near dusk, and a couple of bats came down through, and he leaned back and slipped and fell flat on his back in the water with his waders. It was, to me, it was pretty funny.
Sure. We do hear a number of stories of trout fishermen, fly fishermen, who have watched bats follow, you know, their fly as they're
Oh, yes, absolutely. Sure. Nancy in Bailey's Harbor, hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a question about an area up here in Door County, Horseshoe Bay Cave. We had some really heavy rains in September, and there was a report that was put out that a number of bats had actually drowned in the cave because the water came through with such intensity. And I think that is a winter hibernating area for some bats, and I'm just curious, given that the bats are now on the move, what effect that might have for winter hibernation and maybe the disease? I'm not sure.
Sure. Well, thanks for your question, Nancy, and I'm very intimately familiar with Horseshoe Bay Cave, and we've had a project going up there for a couple of years now, specifically looking at the bats hibernating in that cave. So it happens to be one of the longest caves in the state. It was recently acquired by Door County and is part of their park system, and it's one of the largest hibernating populations of bats in a natural cave, not a mine, but cave, within Wisconsin. So there's a hibernating population of approximately 1,200 little brown bats at that cave, although all four species are present. And there has been past evidence, because the cave is known to flood occasionally, that bats occasionally die during those flood events, whether those occur during the spring and spring melt or in the fall. So with the recent heavy rains and all of the flooding that Door County experienced a couple of weeks ago, we did go up and went inside and to assess damage and mortality. There were only about 70 bats that had moved into the site this early in the season. That's pretty common. And a very small number of bats were drowned after that flood event. So it's certainly within the realm of what we would expect for normal mortality during winter hibernation. And we can't say exactly how often that cave floods or what's happening when the cave floods, but it's something we're trying to learn more about. We certainly want to keep our bat population in any site and across the state as large and as healthy as possible for as long as possible in light of the threat of white nose.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. And David and Jennifer, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew by. Don't forget the big weekend coming up for you, Jennifer. You're not going to get a lot of sleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come see us at the Wisconsin Bat Festival. You're going to meet amazing bats from all over the world.
And that's in Milwaukee. And we've got a link on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show to learn more about it, and or just go to the DNR website.
Correct.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We have been visiting with David Bleart, who is the guy, the leading expert on white nose syndrome in bats. Works for the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center, and Jennifer Riddell, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She's also a cave and mine specialist. So they did a wonderful job today, and I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to visit with them again. Thank you again. We have always lots of things coming up. What's the weather going to be like? September in Wisconsin. You know what? It's far from predictable, but we've got guys here that are 100% accurate at all times in predicting the weather. Our weather guy's with us coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.